Hello and welcome to the Voice of Intuition podcast. My name is Susan Jane and I believe that trusting your intuition is the best way to live your life with meaning and purpose. Each week you will hear about how you can connect, develop and trust your intuition. Through the wonderful array of guests we have on the show and my own personal experiences. Join me to understand how your intuition can guide you towards a life full of meaning and loving purpose. Hello and welcome to The Voice of Intuition, the show that helps you connect with your intuitive nature. I'm Susan Jane and I'm your host for the show. Today we have the lovely Elizabeth. Now, Elizabeth has got an amazing story and we really want to get down to the nitty-gritties of the story and how her intuition helped her get from, well, you saw the title, get from an inmate to sort of a business for herself, you know, her own business. And it's an amazing story. I haven't heard it all. I only know the basics of it. So we're going to drill down and get an understanding because we're often going through these experiences ourselves, these feelings, and we don't know how to take those first steps, get moving and get ourselves out of where we are and moving into the next section of our lives, basically. But Elizabeth has lived it and is willing to share it with us. And it's a pretty full-on story. So enjoy this. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
We're looking forward to it. I want to get straight into it because I want to know how you got, just the basics of how you got from where you were to where you are now before we drill down into it.
Well, due to a domestic violence situation, I ended up addicted to opioids. And while trying to get away from him, you know, I ended up catching drug charges and going to prison. And you know, that's when you have years of your life taken away, like you really, you know, I had to examine, you know, what I was doing to get myself in these situations and, you know, address my trauma and the reason why I kept, you know, relapsing and not being able to, you know, get my life together. And, you know, also just actually believing in myself and like trusting in myself. Every time I ignored a gut feeling, you know, about someone or something, you know, and I'd always turn out to be right. And, you know, we have an inner voice that kind of guides us. And, you know, it was really a lot trying to hash out, you know, is that my inner voice or is this the trauma talking? Or, you know, it was really, you know, a lot. But, you know, here I am almost 6 years later of being out and, you know, I'm doing really good.
Oh, that's brilliant. So I liked how you said to getting that understanding of is it your inner voice or is it the trauma talking? Because it can be so hard to assess the two different ones. And especially when you're going through the trauma, like I can sit back here and go, oh, I'll just do it this way because this is how I did it. And of course, that's really when someone's experiencing trauma and going through the crap that we go through, I find it very condescending when somebody turns around and goes, oh, just do this, because it's not like that. But I want to go a little bit further back, Elizabeth. Now, you said you're in a domestic violence situation. How did you go from that domestic violence into the drug taking? Was that your way of coping? Is that how you got through things?
Well, he assaulted me to the point my skull was showing. And I didn't do drugs before that. Like I had experimented here and there, but you know, I basically smoked pot and like to drink beer. Like I didn't do drugs and I'd watch my whole community, you know, get sucked down the toilet, you know, by these big pharma companies prescribing everybody opioids. Like my generation, we trusted our doctors. We did what we were told and, you know, they got us all addicted to these substances and then stigmatized us for it and then threw us in prison. And, you know, when I went to the doctor, they had to sew the muscle back, then they had to sew the skin back and the brain damage was so bad I would have seizures. And I also found out I was pregnant that day, you know, while I was in the hospital for that injury. And they gave me opioids and at first I took it, but then they sent me to the pain clinic and it was clear they were going to have me on this like regularly now. And I was in excruciating pain. Like, and you know, I've had therapists tell me when you're an addict, and basically what happens is it rewires your brain to make that substance more vital than water. And if there's trauma involved, you know, on top of chronic pain, that is the worst, most dangerous type of addict. That's the addict that will usually never get clean, because they have these other, you know, other two huge issues that is, you know, driving this, you know, addiction. And I tried to refuse it, and I was now on state insurance. I was no longer on my parents' insurance, and I noticed I was treated differently, you know, and now I was in this different, I was in the poor people bracket. And when I tried to refuse, they told me this could result in a call to Child Protective Services, because I was pregnant, and you know, the amount of pain I was in, I was like having seizures, and I was, you know, going deaf and blind for moments at a time. Like, this really altered my life, this one injury. And so, you know, of course I took it, and you know, they said I was on too small of a dose to get addicted. And you know, that's all just big pharma propaganda, you know, to push, you know, their substances and make money off, you know, the suffering of the American people. And so, you know, the abuse got worse, the drug use got worse. The first time I shot up, he literally trapped me in the bathroom and was like, you're going to do it, and you're going to do it the right way. That was his favorite thing to do. It was trap me in the bathroom and literally like torture me for hours. Like, it would start with me begging for my life. And, you know, by the end, I'd be begging him to kill me, like, just get it over with. You know, he'd like burn me with cigarettes. He, you know, choked me with my own curling iron cord. And in it, I just gave in. I was like, all right, just, you know, do it. Cause like, I didn't want to get beat up again. And, you know, the needle itself, like, is a whole other addiction. And, you know, that's, you know, something you, nobody wants to get into, but you know, it just sucks. Cause I didn't really feel like I had a choice in the matter. And, there was eventually like a final showdown between us where he put me in the hospital, and cops ended up showing up, and he ended up getting into a high speed chase and a whole mess of things. I lost my public housing because the cops showed up. So I went to Spruce Run, the battered women's shelter in Bangor, and told them my situation. And at first they called me a liar because they said I wasn't crying. And most women that came in there cried. And when I was 8 months pregnant, he held a knife up to my face, you know, because he started pushing me around. So I started crying. And he holds a knife up to my face and goes, one more tear rolls down your cheek and I'm gonna cut your face off. And so after that, I didn't cry. Like, I didn't cry for years. And, you know, that was some internalized misogyny I eventually had to unpack, because then, you know, I didn't have empathy for people crying after that. Like, you serious? And, you know, then I go to the shelter and they used it against me again. They said, well, you're not crying, so we don't believe you. So I went and I got the hospital records and the police records and everything else. And then they did a 180 and said, well, your situation is too dangerous. Your injuries are so extensive that we feel it would put the other women in the shelter in danger. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, they had two beds open, and the girl that got the bed, the guy didn't even hit her. He kicked her car. And that's domestic violence. Absolutely. You know, destruction of property. You know, I'm not trying to diminish that any way, but compared to my situation where I would have died if I hadn't gone to the hospital, like, this man choked me to the point my windpipe, like, it was damaged. I would have these like fits where my throat would just close. Like, if I got hiccups or anything, because he choked me so bad. And then I found out, like, you're 600 times more likely to die by your partner if they choke you. And that was a really hard statistic for me to face, because, you know, he almost did kill me. And like, these fits would go on for like 45 minutes where I'd have to chug water just to open my throat enough to be able to breathe, you know. And, you know, the trauma, you know, it made me insane. Like, I don't. Like, I was dangerous, you know, after a certain point. You know, I didn't have like conscious thoughts about hurting him, but I would have dreams about killing him. And, you know, it really takes its toll. And people love to ask, oh, why do they stay? You know, why would you stay after that? Because when I tried to leave, I got held hostage in my own house for 3 days and beaten and raped. So yes, this is, you're seven times more likely to die trying to leave. So, you know, that's all. yeah, that's all fun and easy to say, you know, especially when they're financially abusing you too. He took every cent I had, you know, whether my son needed it, our son, you know, anything. He just took, you know, all for drugs. And it was just a nightmare. And, you know, on top of the fact, you know, as someone who's experienced, you know, addiction and domestic violence, I've watched so many people get their kids taken for trying to get help with their addiction, for, you know, trying, admitting that, you know, they want to get out and that they're being abused by their partner. I've watched the state come in and take people's kids for that. So that's why nobody goes and gets help. You know, it's, you know, stay and, you know, deal with it, or try to leave and get help, and then DHS comes and takes your kids because you're a victim. Like, this is the system that America has right now. And it's a dystopian nightmare. And so, you know, once they turned me away, I made a deal with my father that, you know, if they didn't help me, I'd sign temporary guardianship over, because if he showed up with the cops, my dad would have to hand my son over. And, you know, yes, he was in and out of jail, you know, whatever, but it's just, you never know what's going to happen. And since I was having, you know, all that head injury, you know, issues, I wasn't a safe caregiver for them anyway. Like, I was waking up on the ground, not knowing how long I was out for, and going, I have a 14-month-old running around, and I'm not, like, conscious. And, you know, that was, like, a horrible thing, you know, for me to face. Like, I'm not, you know, a safe caregiver for my daughter because of this. Like, and so she started having to stay with my dad, you know, once that happened. But, you know, then Jared came, and, you know, once that happened with the battered women's shelter, I signed temporary guardianship over, you know, for them. And, you know, like, if he comes after me, he comes after me on my own. Like, my kids don't need to be there for it. And once I did that, I lost my health care. So I couldn't go to the doctor anymore. I couldn't, you know, like, I lost all my medications. And so now I was, like, self-medicating, and basically drug dealers helped me. They were the only ones that, like, helped me. And, you know, did they take advantage? You know, sure. But, you know, I had places to stay. I had protection. You know, they were giving me drugs to sell so I can make money. And, you know, because I was so traumatized and so hardened by this, like, I moved my way up pretty quickly. And eventually I caught charges in 2011. And it's like, I always had one foot in and one foot out. Like, I was in college, like, I had plans, like, and instead I ended up getting sucked into a life that I never wanted. And, you know, 70% of women in prison in America have some sort of domestic violence or sexual assault in their past before they even get to prison. Like, we're the women that slip through the cracks. And, you know, we have the highest rate, you know, they gaslight us with land of the free and all that stuff. We make up 25% of the global incarceration population. 25%. We're only 5% of the world. Like, we have more people in prison than entire continents. And it's all to bypass the slavery laws with mass incarceration. A hospital saves $350,000 a year contracting their linen to be washed by inmates instead of paying regular Americans a minimum wage, not even a living wage, just a minimum wage. This is how greedy these corporations are. They would rather put us all in prison and have us work for pennies a day. We make $5.25 a month for working 40 hours a week in prison. And we work hard. You know, some inmates work 60, 70 hours, you know, and it's just insane. Like, you know, you're putting all these people in prison over the pandemic. All these jails across America were taking out PPP loans to expand their jails. The corporation said that they'd buy all the prisons and privatize them as long as they stayed at 90% capacity. That way they can get free workers out of this. And, you know, yes, this is what they're doing. And this is why we all need to come together and do something about this. Because this is where we're headed. And you notice the housing problem erupted. There were homeless people everywhere during the pandemic. Before the pandemic, there were 3 empty houses for every homeless man, woman, and child. Now there's 29. And they're criminalizing homelessness in all these cities across America. And when you criminalize something or a group of people, you put them in jail. So that's just going to add to their free workforce. These people are so greedy and sociopathic. They would rather put us in jail than traffic our kids to the state. You know, this is modern day slavery. This is not rehabilitation. This is not anything they claim it to be. This is slavery. And, you know, if we don't do something about it, it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, it's like, throw them in jail so we don't have to deal with them. You know, it's that sort of mentality. Yeah. And whereas jail, incarceration is not necessarily giving them rehabilitation. It's not doing that. It's just a time frame of chucking them in one spot and sort of going, I don't have to deal with that now, which, yes, I absolutely agree with you. In the studies that I've done, I've seen that happening. I've seen what that's about. Obviously, we're in Australia, so it's very I'm not going to say it's very different because I don't know, but it's quite surprising the data that you're bringing forward. And it's, it sort of hits you in the face a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. My first week at Somerset County, I witnessed an entire pod of women get stripped out because they signed up for a razor, and a male sergeant wanted a list of who shaved their vaginas and who didn't. Those that did got written up. Now, they didn't have this rule for the men. They weren't stripping the men out, you know, analyzing their pubic area to see what their shaving preferences are, you know. And then they apologize for it. They're like, well, it wasn't supposed to be like that. What was it supposed to be like? Like, y'all are taking bets, like who's got a landing strip and who doesn't? Like, what is wrong with you? And nothing ever happened to the officers that did that. Nothing ever happens.
Yeah, there's no consequences for their actions.
I mean, predators flock to these institutions for employment. Like, it's really bad in there because, you know, I've had conservative women in this country tell me, if you don't want to get raped by cops, then don't go to jail. Just say you're okay with certain groups of people getting abused. Just say that because that's what you mean. Like, you literally think it's okay for cops to do whatever they want to us because we had addiction issues, because we're, you know, we fought back in a domestic violence situation and we got put in prison for it. I mean,
it's not balanced, is it? It's not right. You've already gone through all this trauma. You've already gone through all this drama, abuse and everything else to be incarcerated and cop more.
Yeah.
You know, like that's not helping you. And yes, you have had a drug addiction, but there was a reason behind that as well. And
Of addicts in America, you know, or opioid addicts anyway, they start out by going to their doctor. We got set up essentially. And, you know, it's the suffering of the American people is a $1 trillion industry. Then you got the rehabs. They have a 94% failure rate, but it's like $30,000 to get in. A friend of mine was drinking a cup of coffee in the wrong area of the rehab during the wrong part of the day. And they kicked him out for that. No refund, $30,000. He got out and overdosed. And it's so easy to just be like, oh, well, they're an addict. They broke the rules. You wouldn't have those petty rules for cancer patients or, you know, something else. Like, you're doing this to make money, because then you just fill that slot and it's another $30,000. Yeah. Like, it's one big money pit. I mean, the corruption and the profits over people in America is so barbaric. I mean, like, every 6 months I break down and I'm like, I gotta get out of here. Like, I gotta move out of this country. And, you know, then I give up, and you know, it's that much harder for a felon, you know, to leave. But you know, I go through this like mental breakdown every couple months where I'm like I gotta get out of here.
No, I totally understand that. But the reality is, Elizabeth, you can't guarantee it's going to be any better anywhere else.
True.
And
but at least there's universal health care.
Yeah, exactly.
At least they have universal health care.
Yeah. And the thing is that you've experienced it, so you've got that knowledge and understanding of it. I've not experienced that, so I don't have that knowledge. So is it any worse in Australia? Is it any better in Australia? Have no idea. But you could come to another country, you could come to Australia and go, you know what? It's just as bad. It's just as corrupt. And I would imagine it would be.
The numbers prove not, though. I mean, we make up 25% of the entire, like, Australia don't even like come close with their numbers and their crime rates and the addiction rates and, you know, the gun violence. Like, no, America's gone right to hell. And, you know, I feel like we have to, there's a whole other layer with this, you know, prison industry where people don't understand. And I mean, like, and they like to say, oh, prisoners get free medical. No, they don't. They will let inmates die, you know, before they treat them. You know, 60% of the prison doctors in Alabama have lost their medical license. Doctors who have lost their medical license are allowed to work at prisons and native clinics. Like, they are still actively committing genocide in this country. And it's sick. Like, I met a handful of women in prison that had all been sterilized against their will. Like, this was before Trump filled up the ICE camps with the refugee women and you heard about them getting sterilized. No, they were doing this to American women. And, you know, after like the fourth woman, I realized, I was like, not a single one of them is white. Like, and, you know, they've been doing this to the natives, you know, and Black women, you know, for since forever, you know, oppressing them extremely bad when it comes to, you know, the rights of their body. And, you know, they're still doing it. Like, they are still committing these, you know, horrible, you know, inhumane acts in this country. And, you know, I like grew up thinking like, oh, America's so great. Like, it used to be racist, but then we had the civil rights movement and, you know, everything got better and now everybody's equal. Like, I really grew up under that illusion, and it took me going to prison to see things for what they really were. Like, you know, the much longer sentences for, you know, the Black and Brown women. Like, I mean, if I wasn't, you know, a white woman, I probably would have gotten a lot longer than 37 months. And, you know, it's just things like that, that shouldn't be happening. And yeah, I mean, it's just horrifying.
It's actually a little bit mind blowing because I too believe that, you know, like we're not so racist, you know, we're not, because I've not experienced it. I've not been in those circles. I did learn a lot about it in uni. Got an understanding of our Indigenous population and what the experiences that they're going through and how different it is for them. So I have a lot of empathy and understanding of it. But when you're put into that situation, when you're headfirst in there and there's no way out, and that is what you're seeing and that's what you're experiencing, that is, you know, as horrible as it is, what I've really appreciated just in these last 20 minutes that I've talked to you is the passion that you've got to help these people, to bring a light on an area that people don't, the general population don't know about. Because, you know, I have to confess that, you know, somebody's in jail because they've done something wrong. But why have they done something wrong? If we take it back another step, then we start to have a little bit more empathy for these people that are in jail. At the moment on the Gold Coast here, we're experiencing a lot of problems with teenagers, like young 15, 16-year-olds, younger, underage, well, teenagers basically. And they're going a little bit rampant. They're breaking into people's houses, they're stealing cars, they're stabbing people, they're, you know, all sorts of different little groups and sessions of it. Now, we've not experienced that before in that context in Australia that strongly. And it has got people up in arms, but straight away, they're blaming all teenagers. And that's where I go, stop. You've got to stop that. Not all teenagers are like that. It's like, not all Black people are like this. Not all Native people are like this. Not all Indigenous people are like that. Stop putting them all into one big bucket and trying to work through it and go through it that way. But we definitely have gone a little bit off track here, but I love the passion.
Sorry.
That's fine. No, I love that. That's great. Because that passion, I mean, I really get that. That's me to a T. So when I trace back and we go back over it, you were in such a violent domestic relationship, such an extreme there. I get why you don't leave. I get why women don't leave. And I also get the fact that until you are strong enough to be able to leave, you can't do that. Because I wasn't in a physically violent relationship. I was in a emotionally gaslighting relationship. Yeah. So it took a lot longer to leave because I thought I was just going a little bit crazy. I remember thinking, right, I wish it would hit me so I had an excuse to leave, because right, I didn't have an excuse. It was right, like, toughen up, bitch, you know, get harder. Yeah. But I wasn't like that. So I needed to be strong enough to be able to leave that relationship. And so I understand there's either a fear because you aren't going to survive, whether you're with them or whether you're not, and then there's that being strong enough to be able to do it. So I have that understanding. Your go-to method, your way of coping was obviously to go, well, not that you even had that choice, but that's where the doctors put you onto the opioids and got you into that sort of cycle. And again, it's like he had control over you to start with. Now the doctors have got control over you, or the medication has got control over you, until they don't want to deal with it, push you aside. The next thing you've got, which is not by your choice, it's the only way you can go, is to go in through the drug dealers. So I get that. But all along, what was your intuition doing? What was your gut saying all the way along?
Honestly, oh God, that's so long ago. You know, at the time, like, I knew from jump, this was going to be a bad relationship and it was going to leave me like emotionally scarred, you know, whatever. It did way more than that. It left me physically scarred, you know, everything else. And I just didn't listen to that gut instinct. And, you know, I didn't trust myself. You know, I didn't have the confidence that I do now. And I, you know, I struggled with mental health issues. Like, they misdiagnosed me with depression, bipolar, ADHD. Like, I've been through all of them. And, you know, I tested significantly high for being high functioning autistic. So, you know, I always just kind of thought there was something wrong with me, you know, even though I'd have dreams that would come true later on, even though I had like all these really intense supernatural experiences that can't be explained, you know, I always just, you know, thought I was, you know, there was something wrong with me because that's what I was told. And
So you go along that way. And yeah, I totally get that. I didn't go through the same sort of situation, but there was always that feeling that, I just don't feel like I'm fitting into the box that they wanted me to go into. I just sort of feel like I'm a little bit out of the box there. So obviously you've gone to jail because of the drug addiction and everything else in where you were at there, or selling the drugs. So you've gone into jail. What happens in there as far as how you cope, and what happens when you come out of jail? What happens there?
Well, there really is no coping. I mean, I work out, I would write a lot, I drew a lot, you walk laps, but there's really no escaping that. Like, especially solitary confinement, it literally slows your brain down from the lack of stimulation. And it makes normal situations, like when I got out of solitary after 6 weeks, like people talking over each other would send me into a panic attack, like, because it makes normal stimulation completely overwhelming, because the only stimulation you're getting in there is violence and chaos. So, I mean, like when I got out, you know, just going to Walmart and all this stuff, I would get physically ill, you know, from the stress, because it was just so much stuff and my brain was like so overloaded and, you know, overwhelmed, and it really alters your brain chemistry, and, you know, there's just nothing you can do about it. And, you know, there's a lot of like cultish, you know, kind of, you know, authoritarianism like behavior that goes on in there, and it automatically sets off this, you know, us versus them, you know, scenario. And it's just, they do it's a lot of indoctrinating and, you know, psychological warfare and just drugging people. And, you know, it's bad.
Okay. So it, you know, like, I guess I look at solitary confinement and I sort of think to myself, I wouldn't mind some quiet time because life gets so busy, but it's the complete opposite. In what you were saying, it's actually the complete opposite, because you might have that space and that quietness, but as soon as you come out, the noise, the interaction, everything that's going on is extreme.
Yeah. And you have nothing to do. You're locked in 23 hours a day, you know, and if you're on suicide watch, you have nothing in that cell. You don't even have a blanket. Like they give you this big, heavy suit thing that they put you in. And, you know, it's used as a form of abuse. And, you know, like I had a sergeant telling me to kill myself when I was in solitary, you know, and they had me on the wrong medication that was putting me in psychosis. Like I was having flashbacks of being in my old bathroom, you know, with my ex. And I really thought, you know, that was happening. And I was there because the cell was set up like the same way my bathroom was, except where the bunk was, you know, that's where the tub would have been. And so I was having this PTSD, like, you know, mix of, you know, this wrong medication and, you know, this. And then it was in the paper that that same sergeant told another inmate to kill themselves and they had to cut that inmate down from a suicide attempt. And after I got out of prison, that's kind of what started me on, you know, this path of advocacy and, you know, coming on podcasts and talking about it. It was like, you know, I had let it all go. And then I was like, you know what? No, I want my PREA complaint. I want, you know, they did that. She did that to me too. She would write on my, you know, request slips, like, I can't wait for you to get out and overdose so you stop wasting taxpayers' money. Like horrible stuff like that. And she was never even in our pod. She had no reason to have such a personal issue with me. But she was crazy and they let her get away with, you know, whatever she wanted. And when I was in solitary, they have illegal cameras inside of the cells at Somerset County Jail. I've been trying to get my PREA complaint to prove it, but they are not abiding by the law. And so a PREA complaint stands for Prison Rape Elimination Act, and it doesn't do anything. So anything sexual, whether it's staff or inmate, you know, you file a PREA complaint. And they forced me to strip in front of this camera under duress of being, you know, extracted. And when they extract you, they show up 12 deep, all suited up in SWAT gear, electric shock shields, batons, rubber bullets. This is what they use on unarmed women that are by themselves in a cell. Yeah. And they don't care if you're pregnant. They don't care if you're old. They don't care if you're sick. They don't care if you're so out of it, you don't know where you are. And, you know, I just didn't want to strip in front of this camera where I knew there were men watching. And I wanted to be stripped in the shower where the camera couldn't see me. And they, you know, threatened me with this. And I'd watched it be done to another girl. And they threw a canister of gas in her cell that takes the chemically designed to take the oxygen out of your lungs. And it came through the vents and it came in all of our cells. And I wasn't even directly hit with it, but it was awful enough being, you know, just having it come through the vents. And you know, these cops get gas masks, so they don't care. And, you know, I didn't want to fight like 12 officers, you know, for those of you out there who think you can just say no to these people, you can't, they will come hurt you. And so I filed a PREA complaint against Somerset County Jail. And the lieutenant at a different jail in Maine pulled the law, DOJ law book out and showed me that you cannot, by law, they cannot have cameras inside those cells. So when I got to Alderson, I filed a complaint through them. When they got the complaint back, and these institutions do their own investigations, first of all. So,
which is quite pointless, almost.
Enough said. By law, they're supposed to have an outside source come interview the inmate. This never happens. I've never once seen this happen. And when Alderson got the complaint back, they wouldn't even allow me to hold it. They read it to me and told me I couldn't have a copy of it because they didn't want it on the compound. I go, okay, that's fine. I'll send it home. So it's not on the compound. Like, just give me my paperwork that I filled out that, you know, this would never happen on the outside. If you want a copy of your paperwork, you'll get it. And so they wouldn't give it to me. And when I got out, the captain, Captain Grimes at Alderson Federal Prison Camp, and like four of his subordinates all got convicted of raping and stalking inmates and tampering with PREA evidence. So I wasn't even close to their biggest victim. And, you know, these institutions cover for one another. Like the corruption that goes on in there, you know, it's just horrifying. And yeah. there needs to be accountability. So this is one of the bills that I'm working on that I think should be passed federally, that, you know, they have, you know, because I requested my paperwork from Somerset County. Once that article in the paper came out, I was like, I want my paperwork. I want my PREAs. I want, you know, all my request forms. I want everything. They said, we already sent that to you. So if you want it, you have to get a lawyer to subpoena it. Well, you can't subpoena anything without an open case. And to open a case, I would have to have the PREA paperwork. Oh. So it's a total catch 22.
Yeah. Just go spend a circle.
I went to the Freedom of Information Act and they could not find this complaint. I went to the DOJ. They could not find this PREA complaint. Yeah. So it's just gone. So Somerset County is the only one that has it at this point, and they're refusing to give it to me. By law, they have to give it to me, but there's no consequence for them if they don't. So I'm working with legislators to try and, you know, fix this, you know, because there has to be some kind of consequence for these corrupt institutions that don't want to follow the law. They used to love to say, oh, you only ask for a lawyer if you've done something wrong. Oh, well, look at you telling me to get a lawyer. Like, why are we trying to lawyer up? I just want my paperwork. Like, that's it. And so my proposal states that for every day one of these institutions stonewalls an inmate, it'd be like $500. You know, there has to be some kind of, you know, financial, you know, something for this. Because this is, they're all doing it and they're all getting away with it. Promptsville County's doing the same thing, refusing to give people copies of their PREA paperwork and, you know, their complaints. And when you send it in, like, unless if you ask to make a photocopy of it, which takes a whole, you know, that's a whole other, you know, set of issues you have to do, you know, before you hand this paperwork in. Like, so, they make it very hard.
Yeah. So really what you're saying is that you have gone through the consequences of your action. You have had to deal with that. They need to deal. Everyone needs to look at the consequences of their action. And if there is no consequences, then the action's just going to keep going. You know, what do they say? The definition of stupidity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result.
Right.
So you're standing up and you're doing something about it, which is really good. The other thing I want, because we're starting to get a little bit low on time, Elizabeth. So obviously you've gone through all that sort of that situation, and nobody wants to go through that sort of thing. But what I really like is there's a lot of people that would just sit there and go, woe is me, life's crappy, and I don't want to play anymore. Whereas you've gone, no, there's a lot of injustices here. You can see those injustices in that focused area, and you're standing up and saying, somebody needs to know about it. Whether you can do anything about it doesn't matter, but you have got the confidence, like, you're trusting your gut, and you've got the confidence to stand up and say, well, at least I can share the information. I might not be able to change legislation. I may not be able to do anything physical about it, but I can talk about it and I can make people aware of it. And to me, that's almost like your life purpose. It's like that is the purpose of why you've gone through what you've gone through.
Yeah.
But,
you know, it's hard to feel sorry for yourself when you're surrounded by women who have, you know, 5, 10, 15 years more than you. And there's always somebody in prison going through way worse than you.
Yeah.
And that's something you can count on. Like, I mean, I'm grateful for the experience because I never found like that kind of support, you know, in women and, you know, my family even. And so, you know, and I figured out how like tough I was. And, you know, I made a little business while I was in there. I would paint coffee cups, seal it with floor wax. And when I went back on probation, I was at Danbury and they had me paint murals, and that was my job. I made $57 a month. That was one of the highest paid jobs in the prison. But, you know, I continued it once I got out, and, you know, just thank God for Janet Mills changing, you know, Maine Care and expanding it, because that was the only reason I stayed sober. When I got out on probation, I had $1,300 of prescription meds, psych meds that the prison had me on, and no way to pay for it. So I was like spacing out these psych meds that are very dangerous if you just stop taking them. And, you know, they wonder why the recidivism rate is so high. It's like, because they're profiting from it. Like, you know, they just set you up to fail, basically. And, you know, no minimum wage job can even pay for a one bedroom in America anymore. Like there's just, you know, all these people end up selling drugs because it's the only way they can pay their rent. You know, oh, I can sell this bottle of pills that my doctor gave me, you know, or I get my lights are going to go off, or my heat's going to go off, or I can't feed my kid. You know, that's like the pretty much, you know, the majority of drug dealers in America that, you know, they want to demonize so much. And if people would just have their basic needs met, this wouldn't happen. If people had universal health care, you know, if they had stable housing and jobs and could get food should be a human right. And I'm so disgusted with the people in charge because they just voted at the UN, you know, that food is not a human right. I am like disgusted with the American vote right now regarding that. Like, I'm so mad about it.
I absolutely get you. But I can't go along that tangent at the moment because we haven't got enough time. I just wanted to touch base with the, so while you're in there, you've actually discovered or you've actually got into the painting and you've been allowed to express your creativity in a more positive way, which is really lovely. So you were doing murals in prison. And now what are you doing? Tell us all, because we've only got a few minutes to go. Tell us all about your...
I have an environmentally friendly clothing brand based on my art. Like, this is one of my placemats and it comes in plus sizes. So it's very inclusive. So it's all of my paintings and it's made in Canada. And, you know, I did this, you know, brand. I created this brand during my own healing journey. And I just, you know, as women, we're told, you know, our worth is based on how skinny and pretty we are. And, you know, I've seen so many brands just, you know, size their clothes way too small, you know, because it's skinny culture. And I've watched so many of my friends go through like, you know, body dysmorphia issues. And this brand doesn't do that. It's very nicely sized. So, you know, everything actually runs a little bit big, which I was like really happy about because I was like, oh, good. This is going to make people feel good about themselves. And, you know, this is for anybody who embodies the divine feminine. I'm not going to get into genders. Like, I want everybody to, you know, be the best version of themselves and, you know, turn their pain into a purpose and, you know, try to make this world a better place.
Ah, beautiful. And so where can we get these beautiful artworks? Oh, well, wearable art, isn't it?
Yes, wearable art. So it's legalleries.com/en/Elizabeth.Mikotowicz. And you have to put my name and stuff at the end because there are other artists that go through the galleries. I did manage to get it in some stores. And I do wholesale, so if anybody wants to, you know, carry this brand in their store and, you know, help spread the word and educate people about, you know, this modern day slave trade in America, I would just be so elated and love to work with you. So,
yeah. And I will have the link down below too in the description so they can link on and connect with you there. Because I had a quick look. I had a quick look and they look amazing. And you're working on some for Halloween, aren't you, you said?
Yes, I am. We're doing sugar skulls. This is work in progress. It's almost done. But that will stuff like that will be on dresses and bags and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Like, I'm kind of a weirdo. Like, one day I'll be like flowers and butterflies and rainbows. And then the next day it'll be like skulls and like gothic stuff. And, you know, there's something for everybody here. I am also, my book is coming out soon. It's called No Justice, Just Us. And it's going to be in two parts. I believe I'm still in the final stages of editing it, but you know, after 10 years of writing this book, I think I'm almost done.
It took me 3 years to do mine, so I know how you feel. That sounds really good, and they'll be able to get that on Amazon, but we might even get you back on when you've got the book done. We'll see how we go.
Oh, that'd be cool. I'm on Instagram and TikTok. It is EPM_art_1111.
Okay. Cool.
I almost forgot for a minute.
That's all right. I'll forget mine. Thank you for being on the show. That was so good and really quite enlightening to see what's going on in there. And I think we just have to start thinking about prisons not as a place of punishment, but a place of the ability for them to transform and create a new life as they come out. And doing what's happening now, that's not going to happen.
No.
Yeah. So thank you for being on the show. Stay there. Don't go away. I'm going to take a photo in a minute, but I'll just do all the goodbyes and I will talk to you soon. Hey, guys, that was amazing. I was not even aware of half of that. So I think when we're listening to podcasts like this and when we're getting some understandings like that, it is nice to see that other side to it, because it's, again, it's easy to just throw people in jail and go, you know, they're no good. Whereas putting them into a more negative environment is not helping them. You know, let's have a look at how we can help. Let's look at how we can create these areas for them to transform, to become better. I mean, there's going to be people that will never become better humans. That's their journey. But there is a lot in there that all they're doing is making it worse for them as they come through. So, you know, have a little bit of sympathy, have a little bit of empathy, I should say, for those that are doing it tough and doing it hard, because that's how they've got to cope in whichever way it is they've got to cope. But that is all from me this week. If you would like to subscribe or share the podcast, I would be absolutely delighted. If you want to jump onto intuitivenature.com.au, there is online courses to learn to develop and connect with your intuition. And I'm bringing out a program called the Trust Mastery Program, which is going to help you learn to trust and build that confidence that we need to be able to step out of some of those areas that we look at, or those areas that we are trapped in or feel trapped in. So yeah, that's all about that. But I am going to say bye for now, and I will see you all next week. Okay, see you guys. Bye.